This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Welcome to What's News Dunedin, brought to you by Casa Valencia, the radio show that spawned from the 23,000-plus strong local multi-poted Dunedin What's News Dunedin Facebook group. The group has been putting the social back in the social media since 2020 with respect for adult debate and a sense of humour. I'm your host, Richard Knights. On today's show, we talk to our wonderful guest, Anna Noonan from Dance Otipoti, who'll be telling us a bit more about themselves and what they do, as well as helping us look back at the posts that generated the most interactions over the past 7 days on the What's News Dunedin Facebook group. Those posts this week are Councillor Ong barring himself from his own code of conduct meeting, but then trying to claim he was barred by the mayor and the CEO, but caught out on video by other multiple media outlets. The government looking to save $2.4 billion by simply cutting 8,000 to 10,000 public sector jobs. And National to scrap good character assessments for sex offenders if they get re-elected. Welcome to the show, Anna.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
You're more than welcome. Now, before we get started on that news and stuff, we have our pun of the week. I don't know if you're actually in the What's News in the Dunedin Facebook group, and there's no requirement for you to be so. But we have a Pun Day Monday where we get everyone to bring their best dad jokes, puns, and we see if that joke makes it off the page to the spoken word on a Friday. So there's no science involved. The person with the most laugh reacts on their comment gets brought on the show, basically. And so today we have a joke from someone who hasn't won the Pun Day Monday before. Normally Max Reed is one of the people that actually gets a lot of jokes on the show because he's a funny man. But this is someone that's ousted him from that from that position this week. So my husband suggested that we do something romantic and go to the pub separately to relive our first date. So he walked over to me at the bar and said, "Hey, gorgeous, can I buy you a drink?" I replied, "Get lost. I'm not falling for that again." I quite like that.
Yeah,
I can see my wife doing that. I'm not falling for that again. So pun of the week, roaring success. And then we're going to move into our three pop questions. So these are questions that I've decided help me understand my guest. Nothing more than that. So three questions, simple answers, get under the skin of you as a person, right? So first things first, first question, cream teas. So where you have a scone, you have jam, and you have cream, what goes on the scone first, the jam or the cream?
Very good question, age-old question. I am a jam first, cream on top.
That's the only question you can get wrong on my show, Anna, and I'd like to say that you've passed with flying colours. Exactly. So no, it's right. Science helps. Science supports what we do, right? Because you can't spread jam on cream. It just doesn't work. The cream just goes all over the place. The jam's a mess. Like, no one's happy, in my mind. It's got to be the right way. And it's the way to do it in Cornwall, and Cornwall knows best.
Agreed.
Second question, and there's no right or wrong answers from this point forward in this show. Who is your favourite Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle?
Oh, goodness. I don't even know.
Don't even know who they are.
I mean, I do know, but I don't know their names.
So they're all Renaissance painters. So you've got Leonardo,
okay,
Raphael, mm-hmm, Michelangelo, mm-hmm, and Donatello. And you could also have Master Splinter, which is the giant rat, and April, who's the reporter, who's like the female counterpart to the turtles. Any one of those is an acceptable answer.
Okay, I'll blindly guess Raphael.
That's a great answer.
Yeah, great. Okay,
there's no wrong answers with the turtles. Like, genuinely, turtles are like, you know, they're cowbunga. It's just as simple as that. That's the way it rolls. Now, third and final question, and this one is a little bit of a thinker, so you don't feel like you have to jump right in. Have a think about this one. Would you rather have your Netflix viewing history or your Spotify listening history made public?
I can say Spotify is fine. I use Spotify for teaching. I teach a lot of bar classes and Pilates classes to music, and you'll have it's quite eclectic, a mix of very relaxing stuff but also very like energized stuff. But I'm on there a lot. I clock up a lot of hours. People are welcome to. I think I even have a public profile. Welcome to check that out.
when they do that Spotify rap or whatever at the end of the year, who comes up? Can you remember who comes up top for you?
Yeah, well, I was a bit disappointed this past year because it was just this one particularly relaxing track that I use at the end of most of my classes.
And right, so it kind of got that repetition brought you through.
Yeah.
See, for me, I'm not embarrassed by my Netflix history or my Spotify history. Mm-hmm. I've got an extremely eclectic music taste. So I'm everything from sort of the Blues Brothers to Taylor Swift to Ed Sheeran to Elton John to what am I trying to say? Guns N' Roses to Metallica.
A tune is a tune.
Absolutely. And there's not like, and then my Netflix viewing history will be mainly comedies.
Yeah.
And a lot of like those murder documentaries that my wife watches. Like she watches those. You know, Ed Guy, I can't remember his name, the multiple serial killers and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. You got two extremes. You've got comedy
and
you've got nasty, gnarly death on the other side of it. So, but again, not embarrassed by any of it,
no.
I have to say. So,
I mean, I have a shared account with family. So, again, very eclectic, to be honest, with what's on there. But I'm taking it would be a mix of comedy, rom-coms. The algorithm loves to put rom-coms in front of me.
Yep.
But anyway, and then they won't stop until I've actually watched it. And then they just disappear like they've never existed before. But yeah, plenty of dramas, the odd documentary, and yeah.
The one thing that annoys me the most about Netflix is when it gives you those suggestions.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, that looks good. And then the next time you log in, you've been seeing that suggestion for like months.
Yeah, and then
the next time you log in because you thought, oh, that looks good. It must have read your mind. And it takes you away and you can't find the bloody thing again. You can't remember what it was. And you're kind of sitting there going like, well, I was literally about to watch that.
Yeah,
and you've
yeah.
been showing it to me for weeks.
Yeah.
And I've like decided, okay, you made your point. Now I can't watch it because you've kind of hidden it and I can't remember for the life of me what it was.
Oh, I know. I also, I don't know if you find this, that it's like massive decision fatigue when you go on, and I get so overwhelmed actually, even just with the suggested ones, because sometimes I'm actually not that interested in what they suggest, but like I can be like, oh great, I have an evening off, unique moment to sit down, just want to watch something and relax a little bit and eat my dinner. And honestly, I've eaten my dinner before I've made the decision.
I know. Yeah, we do that all the time in our house. You kind of go, how difficult is it to choose something from like 5 million?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know, it should be easy. There should be so many things jumping up at me, but it's not.
Yeah.
And you get decision fatigue. You kind of go, oh, no, just, I don't know. Quite often we'll be finished dinner and then we just put something like we always watch on instead of like watching something new or something different, you know.
Yeah.
No, I hear you. Let's talk about the news. So this week, interesting, Councillor Wong's been in the news so many weeks, every show I feel like I'm talking about him and it is starting to get a little bit tedious for me from sitting this side of the desk. But it's been quite a strange week for him. He had a code of conduct complaint against him. This is his second code of conduct complaint against him. The first one was ruled that he was gross misconduct and he was asked to resign. The second one has just been ruled on this week. So they had a meeting and he's been basically the reason for the code of conduct is that he has been leaking confidential information.
Mm.
Now, I think everyone knows any employment, you know, there are certain things that don't – that need to be kept private for all manner of reasons.
Mm.
He's been sharing stuff like, you know, in the under the auspice of transparency, which whilst I applaud transparency in the public sector, there's also reasons for keeping things confidential to protect commercial sensitivity and all those kind of things. He's just sharing everything that he possibly can, and literally every single email he sends is copied into the ODT stuff, into me and many people beyond. So he turns up at the meeting this week, and instead of going in, he said he's not allowed to go in. One of the staff members came out, Scott McLean, I think it was, came out and said, you're not barred from council meetings, confidential or otherwise. You never have been barred for council meetings.
Mm.
You're allowed to come in. But then he continued to say that he was barred from the meeting, decided that because he couldn't read to the public, which is what he was going to do to counteract the accusations of, you know, or the claims against him, he wouldn't go in. But, of course, he got caught in a lie. In the sense that the media are standing there seeing someone coming out and going, we haven't stopped you coming in. And he's standing there going, see, I'm barred. And it's some of the strangest stuff that I've ever witnessed around the council table. Have you been following the drama that is Councillor Wong?
Here and there, of course. I think it's hard to escape it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I wish I could.
Yeah. It's. I still am a little bit confused that we're in this situation. but mainly, I guess, just to the point which someone can not understand the role and the parameters of it, you know, the how you're supposed to behave and what's acceptable and what's not. I think it's quite confusing.
Yeah, and they're not the rules around your conduct are very transparent. It's very clear what is expected of an individual, and it's neither complicated nor is it unreasonable expectations. That's the thing we should point out here. Mm. We're not asking people to be human beings that they're not. We're not asking them to do things that is unnatural. What we're asking, what everyone's expected around that council table, is yes, they're representing a section of their voting public, but they're doing that with respect. They're obeying the rules, and those rules are there for very good reasons. Again, they're not. You don't read those rules and kind of go, "Oh, that's a dodgy rule." I don't. You know, no one should be having to be asked to do that. You know, you're being asked to protect staff confidentiality and commercial sensitivity and those kind of things.
Yeah,
those are the things that you and I would be asked to do in another job. You know, like even working to the point of working in Starbucks, there'd be certain things that are company confidential that you have an expectation in signing your contract to say, I'm not going to share that with the wider, you know, KFC, the secret recipe. You know, you don't share the 11 herbs and spices, right? That's the whole. But I'm using that KFC analogy because Councillor Wong's used it quite, because he's got this secret recipe that no one knows about, and I'm not even sure he knows about. But it's, you know, the expectation that you go about your business as a reasonable human being is not an unreasonable expectation. But he's now playing the victim, which is the crazy part behind it. So I guess at some point, I mean, they've literally taken away every single access that he's got to confidential information because of the fact he's leaking it.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really weird over the weekend because actually he was on one of the radio shows and they'd interview Heather Duplessis Allen.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I think that's her name, had interviewed him, got very angry with him because he wouldn't answer a question properly. Mm. And then he kind of felt like he'd let her down. So therefore he had to splurge out a whole load of stuff that he shouldn't have said.
Mm.
That's very strange behaviour.
It is strange behaviour, yeah. I mean, I don't want to assume or like state anything like super strongly, but it does look like there's a lot more going on.
I'm genuinely worried for him. There's a genuine concern that what we're actually watching is a breakdown in real life, and that to me, and no one wants to see that. Like genuinely, that's not, you know, whilst some people may find the whole thing amusing or interesting, or you know, just like watching a car crash. You know, you're watching that in slow motion. It's like you can't take your eyes away.
Yeah.
But we could actually be watching someone going through something fairly.
Yeah, that's so
traumatic.
True. Yeah,
you know,
or just that their way of being in this world just, I don't know, either restricts or limits or impacts their ability to understand what most of us understand as right from wrong, what most of us understand as an appropriate way of behaving in a place. And also just, I guess, just looking at the overall situation in terms of someone in that space potentially being voted into council, it's like, I guess it kind of makes me think about the process of how we choose the people who hold those seats and have to, although fight for their own opinions and thoughts and I guess agendas, they do also have to work together. Like everything is decided together ultimately.
Yeah, exactly. By a majority of sometimes one, sometimes 15, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's the thing for me is that I've run for election, right? So I've run for election, three times I've not been voted in. I would consider myself to be, if I'd have been voted in, someone that would actually understand and be competent around the table.
Mm-hmm.
But no one has tested my competency, right? Yeah. No one has tested the competency of the people that sit around the table. I don't know how you test competency, but just because you spent $44,000 and you said you're going to change the world doesn't, and that's got you voted to the table, which Councillor Wong did, it doesn't mean you're have the skills or the tools or the ability to actually enact that promise.
Absolutely.
So no one's testing whether you're actually able to do the job. They're kind of hanging on the fact that you said you could, so they therefore you go into, which seems a very, very strange way to elect someone.
Definitely,
because if you and I were going for a job, right, you're a qualified barista, you've got so many certificates, you've got, you know, you've got all your reels on Facebook that can prove that you know how to pour a cup of coffee. I'm going there, I've made tea all my life, I've got no idea. And you and me go for a job interview, chances are they're going to test both of our competencies.
Of course, yeah.
Right? Because they're going to want to see, you know, they're going to need you to prove that you've got that skill. They're going to need me to show them that all I can do is make a cup of tea.
Yeah.
You know, and whilst I might be prettier than you or you might be prettier than me, it's got nothing to do with your competency.
Yeah.
That's normal job, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But elected official...
I know. It's you can say what you want on your little paragraph in the leaflets.
Doesn't have to be true. Doesn't have to be true. You don't have to be able to prove it. You don't have to actually prove anything when you apply.
Mm.
You have to put your name down and you've got to prove you're a citizen.
Mm.
That is it. That is literally it. You've got to get two people to nominate you.
Yeah.
And that is it. You don't have to provide a CV. You don't have nothing. Like genuinely, there is literally nothing. And after that, everyone takes you at your word.
Crazy, or your face.
Or your face out there in the public.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Yeah, just what people are drawn towards, what feels trustworthy, or what they suspect equals certain skills.
There certainly seems to be a bit of buyer remorse, like out there in the market.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have to accept the fact that for the next 2.5 years, we've got a council of 14 rather than a council of 15. And I don't say that lightly, because actually – that just makes me sad, because the democratic process has kind of let down the people of Dunedin in that particular sense.
Yeah.
Because the influence that Councillor Ron will have on anything will be zero, because he's literally upset every single one around the table.
Yeah.
He's got no friends amongst those people.
Yeah.
And whilst you're not there to be friendly,
if
you want something done, you need 7 other people to support you.
Right? Mm.
If you can't garner that support, then you're just ineffective. So all you can ever do is vote for the stuff that everyone else votes for, because you're just one of the 15, you know?
Yeah.
Or you're just one out on your own, you know?
Well.
And that just feels – and that again, that feels wrong. That just feels like a letdown in the whole democratic process.
Yeah, for sure.
So now we've got kind of – and everyone else is sitting there, well, we've got 14 councillors now.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a bit hard. It is taking a lot of people's time and energy and obviously patience or to a point. So it's hard to see it also being, you know, going
and money.
That way.
It's all costing money. Every time they do something that potentially has a legal ramification, we're now having to pay the lawyers.
Yeah.
You know, so when I say I'm talking ratepayers.
Yeah,
you know,
course.
Because the council has to protect itself and protect its employees. When you've got someone just blurting stuff out, what if the company that they blurt stuff out decides that they're going to sue Dunedin City Council?
And that
becomes more and more probable as more and more things get said.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
which is crazy. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Sure. Government looking to save $2.4 billion, which it sounds like fantastic. But they want to do that by cutting 8,000 to 10,000 public sector jobs.
Yeah.
They want to reduce the percentage of people in the public sector from 1.5% to 1%. Right? They haven't given a reason why, other than the fact they want to save money. And they've basically just been looking at a spreadsheet and kind of going, well, we can save $2.4 billion if we don't have these people working. So they're going to make these people redundant.
Mm.
They're going to put them on the dole, I think, so they're now seeking work. And suddenly they'll save 2.4, but now they're going to start paying out.
Yeah, however much
money the other side.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I genuinely don't get it. Like, and you often hear some people talking, and some loud voices on Facebook will tell you that they're just jobs for jobs. They've made these jobs up. No one makes jobs up. Even the public sector doesn't make jobs up. You don't walk into an department of 7 people and then they go, right, I've got a mate down the way, hasn't got a job. Like, let's make up an 8th job.
Yeah.
We'll get him in here. We'll give him 100 grand a year, but we'll just he can just sit there and do the stuff that we don't want to do.
Yeah.
That's not how employment works. That's not how, even that, you know, while some people think that's how the public sector works, genuinely that's not.
Mm.
You're talking about 10,000 people potentially out of work.
Yeah.
And we've got the highest unemployment we've had for a number of years.
Yeah. I know, it sort of feels like there's one hit after the other. It is a crazy time where it just feels everything's quite precarious, and also it feels quite confronting when people are making those giant decisions and you just can't follow the logic, and it feels like the priority is numbers and figures and money, not people, and the way that those jobs sort of all knit together in the way that our society works and actually strengthens people's experience of this life, basically, to go huge and big. But
I agree with you, because you can look around the country and you can see prime examples of where under-resourcing is hitting us hard.
Yeah,
you only got to look at our health system to know that our under-resourcing has got people waiting longer, you know, in pain for longer, having to jump through hoops in order to get bloody seen. We've got, you know, again, artificially keeping waiting lists low by denying people referral for scans and stuff, right? Yeah. Because that's just underfunding and under-resourced.
Yeah.
You're doing the same thing with the public sector. If you suddenly start stripping out the backbones of, you know, the back office of a government department, and then suddenly you put more people under more pressure, making more mistakes, there's the potential for people to die. I mean, certainly in the health service, there's potential, you know, and we see stories like that every single week where someone got something wrong because they were under pressure or under resourced. And now someone's saying sorry. But sorry's not good enough when someone's dead, you know, genuinely.
Yeah.
And it becomes, and it's like, look around you. You can see the problem that it causes. But you've looked at a spreadsheet and you're going, oh, $2.4 billion.
Yeah, it sounds great.
Sounds great. Well, I'll tell you what, why did you give $2.9 billion to landlords?
Exactly.
You could have saved $2.9 billion that you wouldn't have to save as $2.4 billion. Mm. Landlords would still own the properties that they own. Mm. They would still have the income that they have. But you've given $2.9 billion to those people to then come and say, I'm going to take $2.4 billion from you and you're going to be out of work.
Mm.
So I'm going to take money and give it to people that have got money or got equity or got something physical that they can sell.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take it from someone that hasn't got it.
Yeah.
And it's just the punching down. It's just the consistent punch, 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 punch.
Yeah.
And it does feel continual at the moment, doesn't it?
That's it does.
I've never felt more in the 53 and a bit years that I've been on this planet. I've never felt more squashed.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, and I come from a place of privilege, right? So I'm in a lucky position. I know I am. We've got two incomes in our family. Yeah. We don't have to worry about putting food on the table. We don't have to worry about paying the rent. We don't mortgage or whatever. Yeah. We're lucky. I know we are, but I've never felt more squashed than I do in the world right now.
Yeah,
and I feel for my kids and my grandkids because it's like, what are they feeling?
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot. It's a lot to take on so many levels, you know, thinking about your kids and thinking about their experience of growing up in a planet where global warming, global crisis is in your face all the time.
Every day.
And the fact that, you know, we're seeing genocides unfold in front of us on our screens, and then it's sort of compounded by this weird sense that we can't do anything about it because we're just sort of passively taking it in. I mean, obviously there are things we can do about it, but at the same time, everything seems like it happens so fast, so you just feel like you're trying to throw out fires and keep yourself sane.
Putting out fires and staying sane is like you know, that's my mantra when I get out of bed in the morning. Right, how many fires am I putting out? How sane am I keeping myself?
And it is.
I'll move on from that one just because I was going to run out of time.
But
the next last one is national planning to scrap the good character assessments for sex offenders, but only if they get re-elected.
Mm.
Right? They've got the power to do it right now.
Yeah.
They've got the power to actually go scrap. You know, you've been convicted of a sex crime, and we're going to take into account your good character. I've never understood it anyway, right? Yeah, so the fact they want to remove it, I'm all for that. I'm thinking like, yeah, great. I don't think any crimes should come with, unless it's your first offence, should come with any consideration of what your character's like. You know, I see it all the time. You see, we're not going to give them a criminal conviction because they might be a good sportsman later on in life, or they might want to be a dentist. And I'm kind of going, Don't be a nasty human being in the first place. Like, you know, if you've got to that position, something's gone wrong, and actually just because you might want to do something in the future, why do you get the benefit of the doubt over someone that doesn't? And it seems very subjective how they choose and decide who those people are.
Yeah.
So I don't think good character should come. You know, if you've been convicted of a crime, I think there should be no such thing. That's my view. So this policy is great. But to then hang it on if I get elected.
Yeah.
I just find that so calculated, so unnecessary. Just do it. You want to show me you're good people?
Yeah.
Just do it. You could do it right now.
Again, another thing that I just don't understand about the government's motivations and decisions.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
What I'd like to see is actually all the other parties come out and say, yeah, we'll do that too.
Yeah.
And just squash that, you know, squash that being as, no, we support that. We'll do that anyway, regardless.
Yeah.
And you know, rather than National about to kind of run it with a, you know, if we get elected, if every other party comes out and goes, yeah, we'll do that, then ultimately that just... It loses its power.
Yes, exactly. But to make it, it's just to hang, power, it kind of just feels icky.
To dangle it in front of you, like, and kind of go, we'll only do it.
Mm.
We'll only do it if you let us. If you vote us back in 3 more years.
Yeah.
It does. It feels like, actually, just do it.
Yeah.
Do it. You want to show us how good you are? Do it. I'll support that.
Yeah.
Like, probably one of the few things that from National Liberty that I would support, in recent times. There's other stuff in the past that I would have kind of gone, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, it just seems to be, again, it's just that.
Strange thing.
What's the motivation? Who thought that this is a good thing we can do, but let's just hold it back until, till we get in?
Mm.
It's very calculated.
It is, just to clarify, it's the calculation that I'm just like, ugh.
Don't get it. Yep. Don't get it. Right. Well, I want to talk about you next. But before we do, I want to get a word from our wonderful sponsor.
Dunedin, meet your new favourite bakery. Casa Valencia at 53 Musselburgh Rise is serving up freshly baked bread, pastries and gorgeous cakes. And if you haven't tried the ube donut yet, you are seriously missing out. Our signature purple yam donut and purple yam drink are the must-try combos your taste buds have been waiting for. Pair it all with a hot or cold drink, grab a cake for someone special and make your day a little sweeter. Casa Valencia, 53 Musselburgh Rise, Dunedin. Open Monday to Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. See you there.
Do you know Casa Valencia?
I do. They're, I'm over on that side of town.
So am I.
And yes, I can totally agree that the donuts are delicious, and I love their salted caramel one. It's so good.
I'm an empanada fan. I go in there like every day. Like, they're literally 3 doors down from the office, and I just go in there literally every day.
Oh, so
and
good.
And they just like, they've got my order waiting for me. They know what I'm eating.
How nice.
They are just, and fantastic people in there as well. They're genuinely some of the nicest people you'll ever meet in your entire life.
Yep. Agreed. Yeah.
So, and if you're listening, if you haven't been there, get yourself down there on Musselburgh Rise. Now, I want to talk about Anna Noonan. I want to talk about you and the reason you're here. We got put together, we got connected by Hannah Malloy, who's obviously a friend of both of ours. And I want to talk about Dance Arty Poti, and I want to talk about you and your journey and stuff. So, but before we kind of get started, because I don't know a lot about you, genuinely. I haven't done any research. My research happens as soon as we start talking, right? So I want to find out about you as we're going along. But maybe you can give me the 5 minutes kind of Cliff Notes version of Anna and how you got to where you are today, where you started, how you got here, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, sure. So basically, I was born in New Zealand. I spent some of my early life in the UK. My dad's from the UK, my mum's from Queenstown, and they met overseas. But spent the first few years of my life in the UK, even lived up in the Highlands of Scotland in
Beautiful.
A place called Drumnadrochit, Loch Ness Monster. I did see the Loch Ness Monster.
Fantastic. That's a good claim to fame.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. His tail. Just to clarify.
Oh, of course. He doesn't show his face very often.
No. I've also seen that dear fellow who's like permanently camped beside the lock, who's got all sorts of equipment and everything, lives in his van and like dedicated his life to seeing
Nessie.
Anyway, so we lived there and then moved back to New Zealand when I was about 7. And after a brief stint in Gore, we ended up in Dunedin, and I started more getting into my dancing. So I learned ballet over at the Mackay School of Dance in St. Clair and Karen McLeod, and spent years and years after school going to ballet, and then later jazz and contemporary, and loved it. Just, yeah, that was my thing. It was wonderful. Also, she was just such a brilliant teacher. She doesn't actually teach locally anymore. She, when she retired, she went into examining, and so she examines all over the world for the Royal Academy of Dance. But yeah, just the best start to my dancing journey that I could have had, and yeah, just genuine care. So it was very special to start in that way. And yeah, when I was about 18, it came a moment where Karen McLeod had retired and Caroline Claver stepped in. And Caroline was a dreamer, a hugely creative person, massive amounts of energy, and just, yeah, just wanted great things for you. And she helped me build the courage to apply for a course in Australia. And after doing a year of sort of normal uni, because I also wanted to be a student, I ended up spending quite a lot of that time dancing. Still did fine when the uni papers, but realised I needed to go and do this thing. And so I was very lucky to get a place at the Victorian College of the Arts, which is a kind of conservatoire type training. And it had recently been brought under the wing of the University of Melbourne. So this fantastic, really high quality training with a degree, which seemed to be very important and is very important, but becoming more and more important for the prospect of jobs in the dance world. So I did that 3 years of full-time training in Melbourne, loved living in Melbourne. Obviously it's hard when you're moving from a small city like Dunedin to a huge, well, comparatively huge city, and just finding your feet and getting to know people, make friends at the same time as going through quite intensive training. But again, the environment, the atmosphere was very supportive. It was all about also ways that you could dance safely and that would ensure career longevity rather than just busting your back at, I don't know, 23 or something like that. So very high quality, well-rounded training, and yeah, just so lucky. It's not easy as a Kiwi to be able to afford that kind of training. And I got in just before, I think there was a change of rules or something, but Kiwis, although we didn't have to pay international fees, there was an agreement that you could pay the same fees as Australian students, but you just had to pay it up front rather than with a loan. And I was lucky that, you know, I got a job, managed to pay a year myself. My parents helped me pay another year, and my grandma very kindly paid one of my years as well. So it was, yeah, a massive collective effort to make it possible. But wow, it gave me a lot. And then I moved to the UK because I got some on both the borders of Scotland and England, and then also in Northumbria. So I had a few projects there. And the way of, I guess, a freelance dance career is that it's quite peripatetic and you move around quite a bit. I was also just sort of in that early 20s phase where you're just like, oh, so many things are possible, which is a great feeling and a totally privileged place to be. But yeah, so I bounced back home to New Zealand and back to the UK a couple of times before settling in the UK for almost a decade. And in that decade, I've just felt very lucky that I've been able to do quite a lot of different things, from working as a dancer to working as a choreographer and co-director. I've worked with my sister, who's an actress, and we've collaborated on projects before. I have worked in school programs and working in low decile schools for, I think they call it something slightly different in Scotland, but I was doing a lot of that work, and teaching at the National Centre of Dance there in Edinburgh, Dance Space. And then, yeah, some of my work as a choreographer was picked up by a couple of festivals. So there were opportunities that came with that. So very like diverse and varied. And also between London and Edinburgh, I was lucky to live in both places. In London, I was doing my master's in choreography at Roehampton University. So again, like pretty dreamy. I'm so lucky. And, you know, obviously it's hard work. Any kind of creative industry job, I think you have to really be willing to put in the hard work but in my case I was very lucky. Lots of things came from it, and then I found myself back in Edinburgh in 2019, and COVID obviously hit in 2020, and a lot of my work did just finish overnight.
Yep.
We were really looked after by the organisations that we were working with, but it was impossible for some of those things to continue, which it was, yeah, there was quite a bit of grief attached to that, because it's really hard to, you know, feel like you were about to do something and then it's not possible and it never completes, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But there was a few reasons to come back home at that point. And my sister and I, who were both living in Edinburgh, we decided, right, let's go home. It feels a long way to be away from family at this time. And yeah, so we ended up coming back end of 2020. So we had a chunk of lockdown in the UK, but kind of left before that really quite grim lockdown that spanned from, I guess, November to May or something. It just felt like it was a yep. really ongoing, challenging time. And I was weirdly still quite strongly connected to it, because I teach online Pilates and I still teach a lot of my clients from the UK. So I was sort of going through that with them. But also I was like, we came back and we didn't even have to wear masks at that point. So that was yep. like this weird
yep.
headspace to arrive into. But yeah, so that was the kind of time that I arrived back into New Zealand kind of thought, okay, what can I do here? And those are the kind of thoughts that began the journey that has become Dance Autoputty. Yeah.
So tell us about that. I mean, this, you know, so you've come back. You've obviously, you've been through that kind of like strange kind of grief trauma thing that, you know, when things have sort of aren't happening, that, you know, now you've got to change your life. You've got to change, you know, you've moved country again.
Mm.
And so what is Dance Autoputty to start off with, and where did the idea come from?
Yeah, so Dance Autoputty emerged, we just felt like we needed a name, it needed to become something, but it is basically in response to things that were happening for the dance sector and the wider arts sector, to be fair. Originally, I'd had conversations with Lisa Wilkie at Aratoi over at the council, and I was sort of saying, this is what I see and this is what I think it would be great to support in some way, shape or form, and this is the potential I'm seeing, and da-da-da-da. And I think it's really nice that happened at a time where I'd just come back, and, you know, you're seeing it with different eyes than the city that you grew up in. So it's this like lovely window where you're just like all kind of like, oh wow, this place is great, but I also knew that it had a lot more going on, so why is that not happening? Obviously global pandemic impacts a lot, but yeah, so it started with conversations with Lisa at the council, and also with people from the community, and just in the process of me personally connecting back into this community and trying to figure out what's going on and how do we make things work. Anyway, Lisa directed me to obviously there's a lot of recovery funding going on at that time, so I headed along to Te Arungi. They had a Ministry of Culture and Heritage fund. It's an innovation fund, and basically the idea is that it kind of pressure cooked over a weekend these ideas that were in response to the issues that they were also acknowledging were facing the sectors. And Yeah, it was quite an experience. And at the end of the weekend, we had an interview. It was quite a panel, and it was all filmed. And, you know, here I am just on my own being like, I like dancing and I want things to happen. But obviously they responded to what I was saying and it made sense to them. They felt it was worth the investment. So we received 20,000 in seed funding, right. And that enabled research, enabled like a few pilots at the beginning of Dance Ottoputi, and through that funding we kind of settled on, okay, Dance Ottoputi it's an organization, it's not for profit, it's here to support and elevate the sector and to build connections and to build opportunities, to encourage people's growth. And a lot of my own experience in the UK meant that I'd worked with and for dance hubs, and they're quite popular in the UK in particular, but across Europe as well. And one particular centre that I'd spent a lot of time working for in my time in the UK was Dance Base in Edinburgh, and they had a structure whereby you had professional streams, you had public streams, and you had outreach. And I just loved that three-pillar approach, if you like. And I think just the experience of working for Dance Space in a variety of roles, actually, over the time I was there, it just gave me a kind of a frame or a lens that I could see it working. I could see that it can become a sustainable thing after a while once we build up the kind of level of work, but also just to draw from. It's like, well, what was working there that might also work here in Ottoputi? And also just spending time thinking about, okay, what am I noticing here? Where are our strengths? What could do with some more support? We're a small city, so they won't be sustainable here in the same way as a bigger city. But also there's amazing stuff about us being a small city because so many people know each other. There's a really lovely sense of, people are supportive and friendly towards each other, and there's a kind of, yeah, let's get it done, let's help each other out. So there's this lovely community spirit, basically. So there's a lot of strengths in that.
So what does Dance Ottoputi do?
Oh, yeah, okay.
In a sense, no.
oops, I didn't answer the question.
What does it do? I mean, are you kind of there connecting dance classes and schools, and are you then kind of reaching out to the public to kind of, you know, let them know that these things are available? And what are you doing on a day to day?
Okay, so at the beginning, we were trying pilots of things, so things that would support, okay, so we have a real lack of dance studio space in the city. We have financial barriers. We also are somehow left off a lot of professional dance touring circuits for a variety of reasons. But hey, when things do happen, like say at the Arts Festival, it's amazing, but oh no, people who dance don't necessarily have that much money to spend on a ticket. So how can we, you know, subsidise or make that less of a barrier? How can we address the fact that a lot of professional development for dance professionals in the city, be it teachers or choreographers or dance therapists or, you know, the whole scope, a lot of that professional development happens outside of the city, which can't be funded by DCC, for example. Yeah, looking at ways that we can increase access to that kind of professional development, looking at ways that, especially post-COVID, we could support people getting back into performances without taking on the huge risk themselves. So something that emerged from that is International Dance Day celebrations, which I can talk about a lot more in a moment, but sort of lovely opportunities there. It was also the fact that having paid work as a dancer and a choreographer is very limited here, or especially post-COVID, very limited. So some of it was about how can we create jobs? So we've had City Moves, which is a job for a choreographer. It's a kind of commission to bring dance out into the public. And there's many benefits apart from the fact that it gives somebody a paid job. And also just like by seeing that there's a job out there, it just sort of gently changes people's perception of what their dance community is, what the opportunities are here. So long term, I'd definitely, or midterm to long term, I'd like to see a dance career being sustainable here in Otipoti. And I think working overseas and knowing that I could patch together like some teaching work, some work in school, some actual, you know, jobs where I'm choreographing or dancing and kind of make it work. I think that that fueled me as well to feel like it was possible. But yeah, so in terms of what we do on a year-round basis, yes, we have the City Moves Commission. We have workshops, professional dance workshops, where we often have guest artists from around the country coming in to offer to the community here. It's about building skills and capability here, but it's also about exchange, a sort of exchange of embodied knowledge, basically, between North Island and South Island. It's really, I feel like, a North Island-centric kind of place. So it's really nice to have that exchange happening. And I think there's so much potential for more of that. Every month we put out a newsletter that helps people to stay in the loop. That newsletter is helpful for people who work in this, in the community or the sector, but also for the public who are interested in what's going on. We have active social media channels as well. And that was quite actually surprisingly valued, because there seemed a lack of, where do I go for information? Where do I find it? We've developed a few resources, you know, just an annual calendar that help the sector know what's going on. But we've also done one for the public, where it's like, I know so many people want to get on board with dancing. We all know that it's, you know, so much research is saying this is such a great thing to do, get on board. So we created a schedule of all the dance classes for adults that happen in the city. And it is mind-blowing. When I first started, there was like, oh, I don't know, 45, and the list was sort of slowly growing. There's now over 90 classes for just for adults happening in the city. And within that, there'd be easy 35 styles of dance. And it's so cool, right?
That's amazing. Hold that thought for a second. Yeah. I want to get another quick word from our sponsor, but I'm going to come back to the question for you straight after.
Yeah, go for it.
Dunedin, meet your new favourite bakery. Casa Valencia at 53 Musselburgh Rise is serving up freshly baked bread, pastries and gorgeous cakes. And if you haven't tried the ube donut yet, you are seriously missing out. Our signature purple yam donut and purple yam drink are the must-try combos your taste buds have been waiting for. Pair it all with a hot or cold drink, grab a cake for someone special and make your day a little sweeter. Casa Valencia, 53 Musselburgh Rise, Dunedin. Open Monday to Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. See you there.
First off, I love the fact you gave me permission to run the advert. That was fantastic. Thank you very much for that. But secondly, 35 different styles of dancing, 90 classes. Is there any dad dancing in that?
I'm sure. Actually, there was this amazing project a few years back run alongside the Caroline Plummer Fellowship for Community Dance, Otago University, Caroline Plummer Fellowship in Community Dance. Got to get the whole thing.
That's not a difficult name to get out at all, is it? Cool.
But Matthew Smith, who is an amazing choreographer and dance artist, who's moved actually over to Oslo, he was running a sort of dad's movement class, and he has two wee boys himself. And yeah, just so I loved that idea, that's helping people build connection and relationship with their children through movement. And also, you know, when movement and dance feels, yeah, particularly for males or dads, can feel quite, oh, I can't do that, and like, no, I can't dance. But there's an amazing wave of young male talent coming up. It's incredible. And, you know, dancing isn't just ballet, or, you know, I love ballet, by the way. I grew up doing ballet, so I'm never dissing it. But yeah, there's incredible hip hop dancers in the city that fly over to the States and compete in the sort of hip hop world championships.
Yeah, wow.
It's phenomenal. Yeah.
So if someone's listening to this, like whether they be, I don't know how many children listen to this, probably not very many, but but adults, children listen to this and kind of going, hey, I would like to be involved in some kind of dancing. Can they come and find Dance Hoti Poti and then get sort of like sort of reach out into those
Absolutely.
Various groups? Is that part and parcel of what you provide?
Yeah, absolutely.
And how do they find you?
So Dance Hoti Poti on Facebook and Dance Hoti Poti on Instagram, easy peasy. We have links in our bio. We don't have a website yet. That is coming. But, so Instagram and Facebook are our go-tos, as well as the monthly newsletter. And there's links in our Instagram bio to sign up to the newsletter, to check out if you feel like overwhelmed by the amount of emails that come into your inbox and you just want to click on it when it comes to your brain and you're like, oh yeah, then we put the link for that month's newsletter in the bio, as well as any upcoming workshops, and that timetable of all the dance classes that happen around the city for adults is also in the bio. And we operate fairly open channels, so, people can just message as well and just be like, I heard about that. Can you send it to me? And I can send the link through.
So I heard about flash mobs.
Yeah.
One happened recently, right, didn't it?
Oh, yes. So there was part of International Dance Day celebrations, and this was just amazing. I didn't actually know this. But on the 2nd of May was actually International Line Dance Flash Mob Day, to be specific.
Wow.
It's a thing. As opposed to International Dance Day, which is April 29th every year. And here in Hoti Poti, we gather everyone together for celebrations on that sort of first weekend of May, usually. And so we had a flash mob, line dance flash mob that took place outside the Dunedin Railway Station, which was lots of fun. And we've got some actually amazing photos and footage from Edith Lee Photography and also Craig Birch Moranga, and they've captured just the energy and the feel. It does make Dunedin look like a city of dance, which is so cool. And then, of course, that was taught by the wonderful Cindy from Fun Steppers Line Dance Group. So that was great.
What's Cindy's second name?
Lee, I believe.
Cindy Lee.
Yeah.
Nice. Interesting. My wife's called Cindy. Well, no, I know it wasn't her.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. So in my mind, I've got this vision of dancers, right? And it comes from watching Fame as a young as a young lad. I used to love Fame.
Yeah.
Can't dance for diddly. I've got my dad dance moves, and I think I'm pretty good at them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, I just, in my mind, you guys just go around and every now and then you just break into dance, right? Because you fall around, I've had a cup of coffee, and then, Des is on the piano, and then Leroy just suddenly gets up and people look at me and go, he's showing his age now. But like, you're dancing. Do you find like you're walking down the street and then there's a pirouette and then you just kind of keep going? Is there something different about dancers?
I have to say, I sort of did do that when I was younger. Oh, bless. So it's just like, it's just a feeling. I think something that's just occurred to me whilst listening
to my craziness.
To Fame is actually, that is a reality for some people in the dance community. And there's like that lovely big high energy vibrancy. And I think that is so uplifting, and
we need more of that in the world.
Yeah.
Like to me, like if I'm walking, like genuinely, I know it might sound silly now, but now I've started, I'm gonna run with it. Like if I'm walking down the street and suddenly there's a whole like a dance thing broke out in front of me, like the flash mob thing, I'm walking away from that like lifted. I'm walking away from that with a smile on my face. The world is so miserable at the moment.
Yeah.
Like we need. I genuinely feel like we need more of that. Like I say, I can't dance for diddly, and I can never see myself at a dancing class of any description. But music, rhythm, all that kind of stuff, there's something that is just so uplifting.
Absolutely. I'll sort of sidetrack just to talk about International Dance Day celebrations, because that feels like right on that point. This year we were so lucky to be funded by Creative New Zealand.
Awesome.
Contribution to the annual program, which is a wonderful, it's such a privilege, and it gives you quite a bit of freedom as well in a structured way. But to put money where where it will make make the most difference. And one thing we've been able to do that with that this year is kind of elevate International Dance Day celebrations. It's the fourth year that Dance or Te Porti has brought the community together to celebrate. And it's something so nice that it's kind of simple. You're celebrating dance in all its forms and for all its benefits, and that's super multifaceted. But this year, because of that money, we were able to apply for a road closure to traffic on George Street. And we, on Saturday, we had a whole bunch of dance groups from across the city, as well as a family-friendly disco and just a chance to learn the hustle, which is kind of like a disco-flavoured line dance as well. Line dancing is very popular in Dunedin. It's actually one of the most amount of classes in that style. But anyway, and that, just going back to your point about encountering dance is – and how uplifting that can be. It was so lovely to see the vibrancy on our main street, but the kind of passerby audience, and they just, you know, like that moment of people's faces lighting up.
And that is where we're going to have to stop it. I told you we're running out of time.
Oh, bless. Okay.
Thank you very much. We're going to end with a smile, and that's fantastic. Nice. We just sit there while I round this out. Yes. Thank you very much for coming to the show. Welcome back anytime. Thank you, Anna Noonan.
Thank you.
Well, that's a wrap for this week. Thank you for tuning in. I've been Richard Knights, and you've all been wonderful. Remember, if you're looking for robust, respectful adult debate about all things local and further afield, and a welcoming online community that doesn't take itself too seriously, come and find What's News Dunedin on Facebook and join our fun. On next week's show, we talk to Andrew Wiley, ex-DCC councillor, and we look forward to seeing you next Friday at 12 on ORFM. And if you want to listen to the show again or simply share it with your friends, you can find the podcast at oar.org.nz or even on Spotify, YouTube, or your favourite podcast provider.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.